serves to explore issues of inclusion, equity, and accessibility for people with physical and cognitive disabilities on campus and beyond. If you love making radio, listening to radio, or want to get involved for the first time, come join our collective. We include people of all abilities, experience levels, and backgrounds in the production and programming of our show. Tune in to our weekly show, All Access Pass, from 5 to 6 p.m. on Thursdays for interviews, music, news, events, and awesome dialogues. If you want to get involved, email accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. If only I
could dream we could start again. Hey, why so sad?
Oh, nothing really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three, four.
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific.
You know, I'm so proud of it. It's almost indecent of me.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
Hello, welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. This week I've pre-recorded an interview and it's going to be a little bit extended. So normally, DJ Chris Horrific isn't going to be in today for Parts Unknown coming up after this show, so we're going to play a little bit longer. But because of the time constraints for radio, sometimes there are extended episodes available. And if you're interested in that, go to my website, mariebenard.com, sign up for my mailing list. That's mariebenard.com.
This is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Thomas M. Sterner. He is the author of Fully Engaged and The Practicing Mind. He's been on the show before for his wonderful book, The Practicing Mind, and Fully Engaged just came out. Amazing book, really enjoyed it. He's a trained jazz pianist, an avid pilot, a student of archery, a golfer, and he teaches his techniques to business people at sports clinics and to learners of all kinds. And we were just talking before the interview about how accessible this book is because it is condensed. It's not this huge book. And so I'm really excited to present it to you. And before we jump into the interview, I'd just like to take a moment for us to center ourselves and sit with an intention for this hour. So if you could take a nice deep breath, focusing in on your heart, and just settle into your heart with the willingness and intention to find value and to learn something new that is going to make your world a slightly better place today. And another breath in. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yay. I am so excited to speak with you. I was
talking with you before the interview started that I wasn't able to reread The Practicing Mind, but as I'm reading Fully Engaged using The Practicing Mind in daily life, I wish that I still had a copy of it.
Well, I wish you did too.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pick another one up. And so let's talk a little bit about what Fully Engaged is, what you're trying to accomplish with this book.
Well, what I'm trying to accomplish is that, you know, we're finding in our culture, it's just a byproduct of our culture, the way that we live, particularly in the West, maybe more in just in the developed world, we're finding, studies are showing that we're losing our ability to focus on something for any length of time. And we're also gaining the ability to move faster, to think faster. Our brains are ramping up. We have so much overstimulation that is happening mentally all day long. And we actually, we operate in a state of distraction all the time, but it has begun to feel normal to us because we don't know any other state. And we've forgotten the joy of being completely absorbed in what we're doing right now. And that would be another way of saying fully engaged. When we're fully engaged in something, we have access to our complete consciousness. Our mind isn't running around and thinking about the future and the past. Our thoughts thin out. Everything, we gain clarity and focus. It's a wonderful state to be in. And we've also found from all of our studies that it is how we function at our highest level. We accomplish the most with the least amount of time, the least amount of effort, and the experience of accomplishing whatever it is that we're working on or working towards is one of contentment and peace. It's a wonderful experience. And as I said, it's been proven out in a lot of the sports psychology stuff. This is what a lot of athletes are working towards, but it's also been around for thousands of years in Eastern thought.
Thank you, Thomas. And I love some of the stories that you share in the book about, I guess it's partly to do with thought awareness training. There is a section in the book where you're talking about dealing with a very difficult musician as you were there to tune the piano. I'm wondering if you can maybe share a little bit about that, because that was really entertaining and insightful for me.
Well, the thought awareness training, and we can talk about it more later, is really a system. It's a label for what some people may call meditation, but it's a system of becoming more aware of what your mind is doing. And the reason that that is important is because that your mind is a thought machine, and it's going to think all day long. It does think all day long, with or without your permission, usually without your permission and without your awareness of what it's doing. So if you learn to become more aware, then you end up having the ability to choose where your mind is going to take you and whether it's working for you or not. So as far as the story goes about the musician, I was a concert piano technician. I worked with very high level musicians from all over the world, and it was in pretty much all the different venues, jazz, rock, country, classical. And on one occasion years ago, I had a piano soloist that was coming in to play at the Center for Performing Arts that I worked at. And I had worked for him a number of years before that. And at that time, I was made aware that he had a problem with alcoholism, and he was prone to severe mood swings. And I witnessed one of those when he really went off on me at one time, completely unexpected. And unfortunately, there was someone else from the theater there that witnessed the whole thing. But anyway, he came back. So I knew what this guy was capable of. He was supposed to come in to the theater at around 5 o'clock. The show was at 8. He would be able to sit on the piano and play and all that sort of stuff. And then I would come in between then and the actual show time and touch the piano up and do whatever it needed to satisfy him. The piano had been stored underneath the stage for some time. It was very out of tune. There was a lot of things wrong with it. It hadn't been used for several months. And somehow he came in the night before to the hotel and got up in the morning and was bored and went over to the theater, and some poor unknowing soul let him in and let him get to the piano, which had been put on stage the day before. And he was just outraged at the way that the piano sounded and felt, and was going into a tirade. And this stagehand called me and asked me if I could come in and deal with it. And I said that I would. My first impulse was to be very annoyed that the stagehand had let him on the piano, because he basically dug a deep hole that I was going to have to dig myself out of. And but I, because of my thought awareness, I immediately was aware of where my mind was taking me. And I told myself, I can do one of two things here. I can participate in that, or I can go in a different direction. So I asked myself this question: if I could behave any way I wanted in this particular situation, what would that way be? Because I knew that if I didn't make that decision then, I wasn't going to be able to make it when I was under fire in the theater. So I made a decision of how I was going to behave, and I knew I couldn't control him, but I could control myself. And so I took off, and when I got to the theater, I started on the piano, and here he comes, you know, out of the wings and across the stage, and he was pretty angry. And I thought, well, I want to shoot the first shot. So I stood up and introduced myself and told him that I really had to apologize that somebody of his caliber had to tolerate an instrument in that condition. I explained to him what was supposed to happen, and obviously that didn't happen. But I told him that I understood this was a solo performance, which meant that there was no other instruments on the stage. It was just him and the piano. And I understood as a piano player that no matter how much he worked on his craft, if he went out there and the piano did not operate as a good interface for him, he was going to be criticized for his performance, and nobody out there was going to know that it was the piano that was the problem. And as I was talking to him, I could see that all of the anger in him had no place to go, and he started to soften, his eyes softened, everything changed about him, and he surprisingly said, he asked me my name. I told him my name was Tom, and he said, I'm very confident in your ability, and I will be downstairs, and just let me know when you're finished. So that was it. That was the situation that could have become, you know, such a difficult problem, could have ruined both of our weekends, and his performance didn't go that way. And to finish the story, I finished the piano, went down to his dressing room, and he said, I don't need to play it. I'm confident in you. He reiterated that. He said, you know, it's a Saturday. Why don't you go home and enjoy the rest of the day? So about 2 years later, he came back into town, and he was at a different venue, and they had called me to prepare the piano for him. And this time I was a lot more relaxed because I felt like I had a handle on him. I knew that it was a different situation. But when I got on that piano, he came out of the wings and he remembered me. And he said, you know, I am so relieved that you're the technician here. And he said, I have complete confidence in you. You did a great job the last time. I'm just going to relax for the rest of the afternoon. I hope I see you at the show. So once again, stepping back, there was a crossroad there where I could have gone in different directions. And because I had awareness of where my mind was taking me, I had the ability and the privilege of making a choice. And I also had the strength, which is also what comes from thought awareness. I had the strength to pull myself back and resist the emotional pull that was happening at the moment that I heard that news. So it's a very powerful exercise.
Oh, I love that story, Thomas. And there's so many different layers and levels to the skills that you used. I mean, there was the empathy and the validation and the planning ahead for all of that. But and I imagine all of those things took a number of years probably to develop those skills. But you mentioned that you noticed the annoyance and chose a different way of thinking. And I think that that's really the key for me right now, where I'm noticing that I'll be aware of my thoughts, or at least some of them, when I catch them. But I still get trapped in that idea of, well, I shouldn't feel annoyed because I'm supposed to be better than that. I shouldn't feel angry or triggered or whatever. And then rather than responding more effectively, I go down that train. Do you have any advice for someone in that situation?
Yes, I think that that's a perfectly normal response. And I think the way around that is to, first of all, you're doing things ahead of time. You know that you're going to have the emotional pull in certain situations. Once you become more self-aware, you become more biased towards the noticer or the observer, whatever you want to call it. And you just described that. You notice when you're going in a certain direction. But what happens is that we end up at a Y and a fork in the road there. There is a moment when we notice it, we have the chance to make a choice. But that doesn't make the choice easy. It just gives us the chance to make the choice. So to me, the next step is to have something that is going to carry you through that moment when you notice it, but there's a tremendous emotional pull to go to the left. And you know you've gone to the left over and over and over again. And you know where that leads. And you know that it does not lead to any kind of a contentment. It does not lead to peace. It just leads to a state of agitation. So, and even knowing all that doesn't make it easy to go on the road to the right. But that's the reason why I feel like it's very important to come up with a strategy, some sort of a procedure to say, okay, when this happens, this is what I'm going to drop back to, and this is how I'm going to react to get myself through that situation, those first couple of seconds. It's amazing if you can get through the first couple of seconds of that emotional pull, how much it's like you regain your balance and you get ahead of the emotional reaction, and all of a sudden you start to feel like you're in control of the ship. It's really important. So that would be my advice, is to come up with a strategy, because if you wait until you're there at the fork in the road, then it's too late. You know, now you're really taken off guard and you're reacting instead of being proactive.
I love that. And I actually wrote that down, a quote from page 61 of Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. The quote is, if you don't know how you would like to react in a situation before you're in it, it's a pretty good bet that you won't be able to figure it out once you're there. So the fact that you kind of knew what you were getting into ahead of time gave you time to prepare. I am curious, though, even with preparing yourself and having an idea of how you were going to respond, when he came out in that cranky demeanor, was there still, did you notice any negative emotions at the time, or were you just so prepared that it didn't impact you?
It did not impact me at all. I was prepared for him to be not receptive, you know, to my goodwill. I was prepared for that. I had practiced that. I had practiced feeling what that would feel like, so that when those thoughts started, if they had started to happen, for me, Marie, it almost becomes like a game where when I'm in that situation, when I've made a decision that this is how I'm going to react in this situation, that's been my decision, and I've made the decision that this is how I want to react. This is, if I could react anyway, if I want to be the master of the situation of myself, because that's what I can control, this is how I want to react. Now, I say to myself, when he came out the door, in my head, I'm saying, Tom, game on. Show me what you got. And then it becomes this thing of like, if he had started to get angry, I'd be like, oh, he's stepping his game up. Can you handle it? You know, I mean, I really kind of fall into that. And it really changes your interpretation of the experience and your perspective. Because what it does is it removes the ego, in the sense that you don't start to feel combative because you have to prove your point of view. You know, it's similar to like what they teach you in martial arts, you know, is to yield to the force instead of feeling like you have to be rigid. And to me, I also understood where he was coming from. This guy, you know, he's practiced his whole life, and I'm sure he's been broiled by critics more than once when he's been up in front of people. And I knew that. I knew that he would be thinking, I'm never going to be able to give a performance on this instrument. And these people the papers are going to ridicule me, and my reputation is going to suffer. And I have no control over that. That's what he was feeling. But I think for him, realizing that I understood that, and that I had his back, and that I was on his side, then we became a team as opposed to two people competing against each other. And by the way, that kind of stuff would happen. I mean, I knew guys in the piano technical concert world where one guy told me that he was in a similar situation, and he got so annoyed with the performer that what he did was the concert benches that the piano players would sit on, they have two knobs on each side. They're actually the same knob. They're connected. But you turn them, and it moves the seat up and down so that the person can adjust themselves so that they're just at the right height for their performance. And it's a very personal thing. And that's always the first thing that they do when they come out is adjust the bench. So what this guy did was he took the knobs and he rotated them so that the bench was out of adjustment. And he turned the bench 180 degrees, which meant that when the guy came out in front of all the people and sat down, the bench would not only be at the right height, but when he started turning it to adjust it, it would be opposite of what he thought it was going to do, and it would create this confusion. So this guy was bragging to me about it. He said, I fixed him. He said, I stood in the wings and waved at him. But they just had this, that's what I'm talking about. That, I felt like my path was a much higher path to take in that scenario. But I knew that I just looked at that and I thought, you know, this guy, his performance was, I'm sure, an amazing performance. The audience had this beautiful spiritual experience of this guy interpreting this music. Everybody won from this decision that I made. And I also knew it was for myself. I knew that if I got in an argument with this guy, I was going to feel lousy for the rest of the day. I knew that. So, and I didn't want to go there. So I had my own objectives.
I love that story. And there's also another story about you coaching one of your golfing clients. And I don't want to give away every great story in the book, but it was kind of a similar, like using that challenge as a preparation to improve your game.
Yes, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to learn is that when we feel that we're struggling in a situation, the reason that we feel that is because we're up against a personal threshold. The things that you feel are easy are things that you've already mastered. So to me, whenever I feel like I'm struggling, and that could be even a sense of worrying, a sense of anxiety, it's because I realize that this is because I have not mastered dealing with this situation. I have not mastered that process. And it's perfectly normal. I'm in the process of mastering it. That's the reason why I have to be in the situation in order to feel this way. So I'm in this situation, and here's an opportunity for me to master this. And if I can turn the situation around and think of it like that, then it changes my perspective and also my ability to perform. And I allow myself to feel nervous or other feelings because I feel like, well, that's normal to feel that way when you're in this situation. So I stop judging myself and using those feelings. For example, if you were trying for a job interview and you were feeling nervous, instead of interpreting the nervousness as a feeling of lacking confidence or lacking the skill, if you interpret it as, well, I'm nervous because this is a situation that I'm in the process of mastering and I have to go through these interviews in order to do that, then it changes everything. It's very similar. You know, I studied voice under several different people. I used to do a lot of singing, and I used to get annoyed when I would get out in front of large groups and my body would get nervous. And because of that, and every singer's experiences, you know, my throat would tighten up and my range would shrink and all these different things. And I would feel like I can sing this piece. I have done it many times. I know I have the ability to do it. But my body is reacting to this fear, and it's constricting, and it's not allowing me to express myself the way that I want to and the way that I know I'm capable of. Well, the only way you can overcome that is to get out in front of people and sing, which is what I did. I mean, you can sit in front of a mirror and practice technique and sing and sing and sing, but you have to be in the circumstance that is creating that feeling in order to have the opportunity to practice your preparation.
I love that. We are speaking right now with Thomas M. Sterner. He is the author of The Practicing Mind and his latest book, Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. And just before we get into more material, a thought came to mind. I get the impression that this book in itself, Fully Engaged, you can read, like, you don't have to read The Practicing Mind to benefit from Fully Engaged, do you?
No. It the two of them are a complement to each other, but no, you don't have to.
Okay. But of course, that once you read Fully Engaged, you're going to want to know what went on in The Practicing Mind anyway, so you can get both books. But you mentioned struggle and how how sometimes we struggle. And that brought to mind this sense where in our society these days, there seems to be this push to be the best, to be famous, to be rich, to be on Oprah or whatever that means to someone. And it feels like this constant struggle for more. And I'm wondering if you have any insight into how we can make an impact that's really meaningful without necessarily measuring ourselves against those societal expectations.
Well, that's a good question. I think that one of the things we have to, that is helpful, is if you can figure out where those feelings are coming from. And from my mind, where they come from is a sense of incompleteness. We always feel that where we are now is not where we can be happy. There's something else we need to have, something we need to acquire. And the marketing media, because the marketing media is connected to us all the time through our smartphones and computers and television, they have a lot of opportunity to nurture that feeling and to expand it, which makes us want to go buy stuff and have stuff. And that's just a cycle that just continually recycles over and over again. And we experience the emotional content of that. So I think that for me, where that feeling comes from, I think that we should have that feeling of incompleteness. I think the problem isn't in the feeling. The problem is how we interpret the feeling. The feeling is really an innate spiritual DNA implant that makes us want to grow. It makes us want to be more. It makes us want to accomplish more. It makes us want to expand more. The problem comes in when we interpret it as feeling, I'm incomplete in this moment. Now we've changed the experience of it from a blessing to a problem and an emptiness. And then we begin looking around at all of these people that are held up to us and made to look like they have all these things that we don't have, and life is passing us by. In reality, when you ask those people, a lot of them are very miserable. That's the reason why you have so much drug addiction and other problems, and people that have more money than they could ever spend, more fame than they could ever spend. I think we lose sight of, you know, who we really are and what we have in front of us and in terms of what we can accomplish. So for me, I think that when you can learn to accept that feeling as being a good thing, a thing that's supposed to be there, and interpret it correctly, then you become more in line with whatever it is that your purpose is, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. You also let go of this attachment to these other things, these goals and everything. There's nothing wrong with having a goal, but when you become attached to it, then what ends up happening is it makes the experience of achieving it a miserable experience, because the process of achieving it, takes on the sense of struggle. So I feel like, you know, to answer your question, when we can accomplish these things, then we become a much more whole person all the way around. And the energy that we give off to everybody around us is completely different. And that's when we're making the impact. I mean, people that are happy and fulfilled are so much fun to be around. People that aren't, they drain your energy.
Thank you, Thomas. Again, we're speaking with Thomas M. Sterner. He is the author of Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. And The Practicing Mind is his previous book, also amazing. And, oh, there's so many directions that we could take. Because we were talking about that feeling of incompleteness, I really liked that question that you have in the book, that using that feeling of incompleteness as a trigger to ask, and then what? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's something that I learned a long time ago just by watching myself. And I found myself saying it to other people. But I would find people and myself in this situation where they were feeling very incomplete, and I can't be happy. I got to get through this. And once I get through this, then everything's going to be okay, and da da da, and on and on. And when I begin to have that feeling, I would ask myself this, I would use this phrase, and then what, as a trigger to ask myself, all right, let me imagine what it's going to feel like when I have accomplished whatever it is that I feel like I need to accomplish in order for this feeling to go away. And I would actually visualize it and say, okay, you know, it's this new smartphone, it's this new car, it's whatever it is, it's this new job, it's whatever. And I would, okay, when I get to that point and I have that thing and I have it in my hand, or I've acquired it or I've accomplished it, and then what? Is my life going to feel fully realized? Am I going to never feel impatient? Am I never going to have a longing for anything? Or am I just going to replace that thing with the next thing and start the cycle over again? And the answer is, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to replace it with the next thing and start the cycle over again, because that's what we've been doing ever since we've been children. So many things that we've wanted, whether it was something for Christmas or whatever, we get it, but the feeling never goes away, and we just completely are constantly participate in this cycle, even though it never brings any contentment. And I think that the and then what, it does two things. It reminds you of that. It pulls you back into the present of what you're doing, and so that you can refocus and reboot and get back to that, where I am right now is where I should be. And it allows you to pull yourself back into that. And it also gives you perspective. I feel like it kind of breaks the spell of, because we make these goals. And as I said earlier, we immediately become very attached to the moment when the goal is realized. And then that becomes where our mind is. Our mind is no longer on achieving the goal. It's never on the moment of what we're doing right now. It's so interesting to me when you begin to experience present moment functioning and living totally in the present moment, because it's the only thing that's really authentic. It's the only thing that's real. The future isn't real because it hasn't happened yet. The past is already gone. But most people choose to spend every moment of their day everywhere but where they are. And so it's an amazing experience when you can begin to pull yourself into the present. And once you see that, then you become more motivated to work towards making it more your default mode of operation.
Oh, there's so much in there. When you mentioned contentment, the question comes to mind, and I think you kind of already addressed this. My idea is, well, if I already feel content, then where's my motivation to do more or to grow going to come from?
Well, I don't think that contentment cancels out to me, when I'm happy, I want to do more. You have more energy. You don't feel regretful. There's so many things that are stealing your energy. I think that because you feel what I experienced, which I wrote about in The Practicing Mind, there was, as a musician, and I'll just relate one story from that book. When I was young and I started playing the piano, I was working on new stuff, and I was working as become a jazz pianist, and I was trying to play a certain run and I couldn't do it. And I really got disgusted with myself. And I felt like I had this moment where I felt like, I'm just never going to be any good as a musician. So I decided to approach that with a very methodical procedure. And I sat down and I wrote down all these things that I thought were going to make me feel like I had arrived as a musician. And I put them on a piece of paper, and I put them in this portfolio thing that I carried around with me for all my music work. Well, I had figured that it would take me 5 years to accomplish everything. They were pretty lofty goals, and I really completely forgot about them as I just continued to work at music. And 2 years later, I was in college, and I was practicing in a music room one Saturday night. And I was again trying to play a piece that was just outside of my grasp. It was beyond my threshold of ability. And I was getting frustrated with it. And I finally said, you know what? I stink. I'm never going to be any good. I've had enough for one night. And I started packing all the stuff up. And that piece of paper that I had written my goals on fell out onto the floor. And I hadn't seen it since I had done it. I had completely forgotten about it. And I picked it up and I was stunned. I read down the list, and what I had thought would take 5 years, I had done all of it in less than two. And it was an epiphany for me, because I had this initial reaction of, why am I doing this? This feeling is never going to go away. I've done all these things that I thought would make me a good musician, and I still feel like I'm not a good musician. And then right after that, I had this realization that that's because music is infinite. Our ability to expand is infinite. And I couldn't comprehend being where I'm at back when I wrote that list. Now that I'm here, I can't comprehend what's over the horizon in the distance. It's always going to be that way. There's always going to be this unlimited, infinite amount that I can expand and I can grow. So that makes it wonderful because I'm never going to run out of room to be better. And so if I let go of this, I have to get to here. Now that I know, well, when I get to there, that's just part of the process of expanding as a musician and as an artist. Just let go of that. I can't be happy here. I got to get to there. Then I can be happy. And just enjoy the fact, and this is to answer your question about contentment, to experience the contentment in this continuing knowing that I am constantly expanding. Every note I play, every repetition of a scale, I'm creating synapses in my brains that are going to serve me in so many different ways, not just in the particular scale and this particular music piece, but sometime 2 months from now, I'm going to be out on a job and I'm going to have a musical idea. And when I try to play it, my brain is going to be there. Yeah, I can make your fingers do that because you've done this scale so many times. And so every repetition, there's nothing wasted. Everything that I'm doing is going into making me expand. And that's like this amazing feeling of contentment in the experience of expanding. But I didn't recognize it before that.
Thank you, Thomas. And you mentioned the word repetition. And I like that word because it's like when you go to the gym and you do, like, say, 12 reps in a set of lifting weights. And we expect that. We expect to do repetitions if we're doing a practice of, like, some physical practice. But that's what life is. It's a physical practice, and it requires repetition.
That's correct. My definition of repetition or practice is the repetition of a process, whether it's mental or physical. It can be trying to be a better parent. It can be trying to be better at saving money. It can be trying to take the golf club away in a different direction, which is going to improve your swing. It's a repetition of a process with the intention of accomplishing something specific. The intention is very important because it implies a conscious awareness of what you're practicing. I mean, it's different than learning. Because you can learn bad behavior simply by being around people that behave badly. There's no intention there for you to learn bad behavior. It's just a byproduct of being around someone who behaves badly. Practice, to me, that's the difference between practice and learning, because learning is part of practice, but practice is bigger than learning because it has this intention in it. And everything, absolutely everything that we accomplish in life, everything that we do in life comes through repetition. That's what it is. You know, I mean, whether it's learning to walk, learning to talk, learning how to read, learning the sounds of the letters in the alphabet, learning how to handle a broken heart, learning how to lose a family member through an illness, all these things, they come through repetition. The first time is always the most difficult, and it gets progressively easier as we go through these repetitions. So I think when you accept that, you can participate in the repetition with a full consciousness.
Thank you, Thomas. And again, we're speaking with Thomas M. Sterner. He is the author of Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. And he's also author of The Practicing Mind, his previous book. And before the interview started, we were talking about the size of the book and how light I felt, how excited I felt to see this book that was not so big. And you mentioned that a lot of your readers say that they're able to read it 4 and 5 times. And since we're talking about repetition, I'd like to take a moment to talk about the importance of reviewing the material, because so many people that I meet with, as well as myself, because I've got a different interview every week, so I will learn this information on an intellectual level. I'll have it stored somewhere in my head. But unless I'm repeating it and reading it again and again and practicing the steps again and again, it's just there. It's like sitting in a folder on my desktop that I never open.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to make the point that everything is done through repetition, and repetition builds habit. And, you know, the neuro studies have said that, you know, we are basically, we operate off of habit. And the reason for that is because our brains like habit, because it reduces the processing load. You know, when the brain can make something into a habit, it takes very little processor to run the habit. It's just a learned response. And what happens is that when you learn something for the first time, that's why it demands your full attention. If you think about things like learning to drive the car or something like that, you know, the first time you get it, it's almost overwhelming. You're trying to do all these things, but eventually you get to a point, which I think is kind of ironic, because the higher your skill gets, the harder it becomes to pay attention, because the stuff has become so automated within you and the brain wants to drop it into a habit. But when you're operating in a habit, there's not much consciousness in there. There's not much awareness or choice making in there. So what we're talking about here is we're doing these things over and over again, and we're making them into a habit. And when we want to change it, which is what you're just mentioning, when you learn something new and you go, you know what, I really want to make that part of my personality. Well, you're pushing out of a habit that you have repeated thousands of times in your life, and it's going to be difficult and really impossible unless you consciously practice it. You repeat it with an intention, a conscious awareness of, I'm doing this so that I can now make this the default way that I handle this situation. When this situation comes up, I want my natural reaction to be this. And it's amazing how we can teach ourselves this if we become more conscious of what we're habitualizing in our life.
Thank you, Thomas. That brings up another question for me. I had started a book club to study a book, and in the first chapter, it was saying how this is a book that you want to read again and again, and really, if you practice the concepts, it will change your life. But if you just read it once and move on to the next thing, you're not going to get as much out of it. And we all read the same book. We all talked about it. But then as soon as the rest of the people in the book club had finished the book, they were like, okay, well, what book are we on to next? And I was like, hang on, I thought we were going to practice this. So I'm just wondering if you have any ideas on how to get this idea across to people who are in that, the seeking of knowledge is very satisfying because you learn something new, you get a hit of dopamine, it feels good. The practice cannot be as exciting. So how do you help people feel like they're getting rewarded? Yeah, I don't know how to phrase that.
Well, I would say the very fundamental thing is they have to want to change that aspect of themselves. I mean, if they don't understand the value of the practice or they disagree with it, it's pretty difficult to change that. You know, I mean, you've all met people that have behaviors and you say, you know, that behavior is not serving you well, but if they don't agree, it's pretty hard to get them to change. So the first thing to me would be that somebody would have to have the desire to want to take another look at that. So in that situation there, they would have to want to change the way that they're viewing that situation. But going back to the thought awareness, they can't change that, their experience of that situation, if they're not aware that they're behaving that way. So it's like, you know, if you want to be a more patient person, you have to be aware of when you're being impatient. And a lot of times people aren't. They're just behaving impatiently. So I think in that situation there, it's important that the person kind of goes back to the discussion we had about the piano soloist. You have to be able to make the decision beforehand that this is what I want to do. If I could be any person I want, would I want to be someone who wants to practice this, or do I just want to be someone who reads the thing one time and then moves on to the next book? You have to be able to be objective like that, because if you can't, then I don't see how you're going to convince somebody of the value of practicing something over and over again. Does that make sense?
It does. And as a coach, you must face that. I would imagine a lot of your clients, again, I'm at a loss for how to phrase this. I would imagine a lot of the clients that you take on are willing to put in the practice. Otherwise, there's not really much point.
Well, what has happened with them is that they have realized the path they're on is not serving them to its fullest extent. They're not reaching their potential. It's back to the fork in the road. They've gone down the left side hundreds and hundreds of times. They know what it feels like. They know where it leads. And they've made a decision that, look, I already know where that goes. I know how it feels. I need a change. I need to go in a different direction. And they have an understanding that that will take a certain amount of commitment. And also an understanding that it takes repetition, and repetition takes time. You know, when you're trying to change something in your personality, there's a couple things that have to happen. Number one is you have to repeat the action. But that means that the circumstance has to come up. And that's one of the reasons, you know, that I won't coach somebody for one session. You have to do a couple of sessions, because many times the things that they're trying to change, it's like a piano lesson. You go to the piano lesson and you say, I want to learn how to play, you know, jazz. And the guy says, okay, well, I want you to do this, 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 and this. If you never see the guy again, then you never have any feedback. You never have anybody looking at what you did with the information. And that's what I find so fundamental to working with people, is that you have to stay with them long enough so that they go through the circumstance a couple times, and then you can ask them, okay, let's look at how you handled this situation. It's amazing the conversations that come out of that and the self-realization that comes out from people when they start learning to observe themselves more. And that's really what they do. I mean, my goal was to teach people to not need me. I mean, that's really the way it should work, is to teach them to be able to look at themselves and be able to be aware of when they're not in the present moment, when they're not being aware of their thoughts, and also to not judge themselves for where they are on the path, to just bring themselves back on the path.
That's the thing that I'm still needing to practice more. I'm getting better. But the judging of, oh, I didn't get it perfect that time, so.
Well, I could speak to that for a second. On there is a chapter in Fully Engaged about understanding your goals more fully, because the problem when we make goals is that we need goals. Otherwise, we're basically a sailboat without a rudder. You're just getting blown around by the wind. You know, you need a goal in order to have some place to steer your energy and to steer your effort. But what we usually do is we immediately attach ourselves to this time frame. We come up with this time frame, which generally has no information about how long it should take to accomplish this goal or whatever it is that we're trying to achieve. But we still come up with this arbitrary time frame, and we're not even aware that we do it. It may just be a feeling. And then what happens is we begin to judge our progress based on that timeline. And that timeline might be just so ridiculously out of proportion. The analogy, the example I always give, and I not to repeat myself, but only because it's one that everybody can understand, is a weight loss thing. You know, you can say, I want to lose 20 pounds and that should take me, I don't know, 10 days. Well, that everybody that would hear that would say, that's absurd. But that's basically what we do. And so if you follow that through, what's going to happen? Well, it isn't going to matter what kind of a diet you put yourself on, assuming it's a safe diet, what kind of exercise program you put yourself on, how conscientious you are of your nutrition and your sleep. And you could be doing everything absolutely top of form, and you may be losing weight on an accelerated rate, but you're not going to lose 20 pounds in 10 days. But if you're thinking that you're thinking that I should hit that goal, then 5 days into it, you look at it and you go, well, I've only lost, 4 or 5 pounds. I'm a failure. Your confidence goes away. All these things occur. So I think it's very important to understand this whole judgment thing serves no purpose. It, to me, that's another thing in the practicing mind, is talking about how judgment is such a folly. It's something that really steals us of our confidence, of our motivation, and it serves no purpose. So I think that it's really important to learn to not judge, to be where you're at and just focus on what you're doing, and also understand the reality of the situation, such as if you're going to pick goals, to understand that you may not be able to get all the data. When you set your goal, you may not have access to all the data. Just like, for example, when I did the piano music thing, I thought my perspective of how good I could be as a musician was limited by where I was as a musician. And As I got better, my ability to perceive how good I could get was constantly growing. And that's why I'm saying you can't always have all the data that you need to make an accurate accurate analysis of how long it should take to accomplish something or how good you can be at any particular thing.
Thank you, Thomas. And I just want to pull, it's right on the back of fully engaged, using the practicing mind in daily life. There's a quote from the book. It says, your goals should inspire you, not serve as a reminder to what you have left to accomplish. Understanding all that is involved in reaching your goals frees you to experience the joy of achieving them.
That's right, because it removes judgment. And that's the thing. You know, we all have goals. I think about sailing because I love to sail. You know, there's a saying in sailing that when you leave the marina, you've reached your destination. And that's because in sailing, the reason you pick a destination is so you can experience the fun of sailing the boat. That's the whole thing. So you say, let's sail over to that point over there that's 5 miles away. Okay, now you have a reference to steer the boat, so you know where you're going, but now you get to enjoy the process of working the sails and you know, looking at the wind and doing all these things. That's the whole joy of the thing. If you just say, well, this stinks, you know, now we got 5 hours before we get over to that point over there. Like, you've missed the point of sailing, you know. So to me, we do the same thing to ourselves with these goals. We have these goals that we want to accomplish. But we forget that the reason the goal feels so satisfying when we do accomplish it is because of the process of accomplishing it. That's what makes the goal feel good. And, you know, I had a clinic one time with some young people in golf, and I asked them, why does a good shot feel so good? And I get all these goofy answers. I said, well, isn't it because you've hit so many bad shots? And they were stunned. They said, yeah, I never thought of it like that. And I said, well, that's why it feels so good, because you've got this reference point of all you've been through. Look at how I used to hit the ball. Now look at how I hit it. This is why it feels so good. If you could just hand somebody a golf club and they could hit the ball pure every time, they wouldn't play. They would be bored with it, and there'd be no challenge. That's what the human spirit wants. It always wants more. It always wants to expand. It always wants a challenge. That's a blessing. We should embrace it and stop pushing against it.
Thank you, Thomas. And I think, as well as when you hit that perfect shot, I notice this when I'm playing pool, which I am not practiced at and I'm not good at. But if I do line up a shot and intentionally hit it in, that's a moment when I'm fully engaged. I'm in the zone, and you can feel it. You can feel that it's going to go in, and that's so satisfying.
It is, and that's what, particularly in a sport like golf, that's so mental, because you have time to be mental in golf. It's not a reactionary sport like, say, baseball, where a guy's throwing a pitch at you and you have to react to the pitch. In golf, the ball just sits there and waits for you forever to swing the club and hit it. So you have a lot of time to think, plus then you have a walk to the ball. And this is what they have, you know, this whole zone thing has a lot to do with how many thoughts are going through the mind, how quiet the eyes are. You know, if you watch people that are nervous and they have a lot of internal dialogue, their eyes are darting all over the place. If you look at someone that's super focused, their eyes are very quiet. There's all these study that is going into this about the zone. And you're right. That's what it feels like. Your thought process is very thinned out. There's not a lot of thinking going on. And your mind is quiet. It's very clear and it's very focused. And it's an experience that everybody recognizes when they're in it. But getting there that's the challenge, is to be able to get there on demand.
Mm. Oh, this has been such an amazing conversation, Thomas. And I do have another question I want to ask you, but I have a feeling it might take us over time. Are you okay with that, or do you need to go?
Yeah, I'm all right. Go ahead.
Okay. So again, we are speaking with Thomas M. Sterner. He is the author of Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. And also, before I get into this question, if people want more information about what you do, they maybe want to work with you as a coach, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, the main website landing page is tomsterner.com. So it's just TOMSTERNER.com. And from there, they can get to the coaching page. They can find out more about the books, where you can buy them, that sort of thing. There's also, I created the Practicing Mind Institute last year, and there's also a page that is the practicing mind, which is basically just for the about the book. But they can get to all that from thetomsterner.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So there is, I wish I had written down the page number, but in the book, The Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life, you mentioned something that I'd never really thought of, and I think it was related to how in this day and age, we are so overwhelmed with information all the time. But you mentioned that there was actually a paradigm shift way back when the printing press came out, because prior to that, many people couldn't read. This information was not widely available. So I was just, that blew my mind, the idea of that happening and how we go through these paradigm shifts throughout our personal history and our history of humanity. So I'm just wondering if you have anything that you want to say about that concept.
Well, the concept was just something, it was just an observation, a personal observation on my part. And that was that before the printing press, as you say, you know, books were not widespread. There wasn't anything for people to read, so they didn't have to know how to read. And if you look at the brain, and this relates to the fact that our brains are changing. Our brains are being asked to function at a higher rate and not asked to focus on the moment. And so the brain is evolving in that way. It's obeying what it's being, it's complying with what it's being asked to do. The problem with that is that when we want to reel our mind in, when we need to, when we want to focus on one thing, even to have a conversation with people, we're not very good at it. I see that many times when I'm talking to people, they can't pay attention for more than a couple minutes. In fact, there was just a thing that my web team was telling me. They were talking about how they had been able to speed up the page loadings on the websites because statistically, for every second it takes for your page to load, you lose a certain percentage of visitors. I mean, that's where we're at, you know, so that's how short our attention span is. And I thought, this is what's happening with our brain now. It's the reason we need to combat it with the thought awareness training. But if you go back in time, I just thought of before the printing press, there was no reading. And then all of a sudden, now there's these books and people have all these words, and the brain had to learn to the phonetics, it had to learn to put this letter with this letter to form this word, to form this sentence, and then to create this picture in their mind. Our brain does that for us now. We don't think about it. We read a sentence and we have a visual in our mind. But there was a time when the brain had to learn how to do that. And that's what our brain is doing now. It's having to learn how to cope with this hyper-paced culture. And as it does that, it's letting go of another function that we don't want to lose, and because it's very important to our happiness. If you look at all the great art in the world, you know, the Sistine Chapel and the sculptures and the great music that's been written, it's all come from present moment functioning. And we just want to make sure that we don't lose that.
Beautiful. And I'm curious also now, Thomas, that you have been practicing for so long, how much of your life do you actually spend fully engaged in the present moment?
Well, to be honest about that, what's interesting is I'm not sure if I'm in it more, if I'm more fully engaged, or sometimes it feels like I'm less because I'm more aware of when I'm not. You know, that's the paradox here. As I said earlier, you can't practice being fully engaged. You have to know when you're not fully engaged to practice being fully engaged. And because just like in meditation, you know, thought awareness training, when your mind kind of starts to wander, you pull it back. You have to notice that it's not on your task and pull it back. So I would say maybe 60% of the time, you know, it's a lifelong work. It's like exercise to me. I tell people that you never get to a point in your life where you go, you know what, I've exercised enough. I don't need to do this anymore. So to me, this is a life practice. You're never as good as you can be at it. What does happen is the blessing of it is as you practice it and pretty quickly into it, you begin to become aware of when you're not being fully engaged. And I may be fully engaged more. What I do is I give myself permission at times for my mind to wander. For example, I may take a walk. I walk 6 miles every morning through a wooded path. And sometimes my mind will be like a toddler in a toy store. It just wants to run and visit all these things. And sometimes I will just allow myself to do that. I'll just say, okay, I'm making the choice that I'm going to just allow my mind to run all over the place and talk to myself if it needs to, whatever. But then I'm able to shut it off. When I get back from the walk, I say, now it's time to get to work. It's time to reel it in. And that's what repetition and practice does. So I don't necessarily think that we have to be in the present moment all the time. I know it's when we function at our highest. There really is no doubt about that. It's been proven both through centuries of Eastern thought and what those people have accomplished, but it's also been proven in all these university studies, all the Western mind, empirical.